All right, so this is our spring thematic study of the Bible, where we take just a theme that runs from Genesis through Revelation and watch how, because the Bible's a theologically unified, historically rooted, progressively unfolding, and ultimately Christ-centered narrative of God's covenant work in our world to redeem sinful humanity and His creation. You can take these themes and watch as it's developed throughout Scripture and comes to its climax, its clearest picture with Jesus, God in the flesh, and then how that begins to play out with his followers in Acts and the epistles and things like that. And so the reason we say it's progressively unfolding is it's not like new truths are being taught necessarily in the New Testament, but the lights keep coming on and on so that it's developed and you see it in its fullness. And so we've done a lot of themes. It's been fun. I've learned a ton through this that I didn't know. The whole thing 2 weeks ago about anointed, I'd never studied that before, but it was cool to me. So now you've just started getting things that I think are cool. So that's always kind of dangerous, but that's what we've been doing. Let me pray for us, and we'll dive into our next theme. Father, thank you for Sunday morning. There's something special about Sundays that you have set aside to rest, to be reminded that you are our creator and our redeemer, and that you are worthy of our worship. And so I pray that even Sunday school would be instruction in that, and that we'd grow in our love of you this morning. In your son's name I pray, amen. All right, so the theme we're gonna look at today is justice. And again, my friends from the Bible Project are basically doing everything for us. We're gonna watch their video. I'm gonna stop at 10:15 to watch it so we can have time to discuss. But justice is a biblical motif that curves its way through the entire biblical narrative and has its climax in Jesus, all right? So, and what's interesting, as soon as you say justice, or if you add the word social justice or anything like that, you start realizing everybody is talking about this. And it's not new. Everybody's been talking about this for a long time. And it's pretty complicated. But the Bible does talk about it all the time. And so, there's no way that it's not, we won't end the Sunday school and it will not cease to be complicated. It's still very complicated. But I do hope that by the end of Sunday school, you see this, that justice and so much of what our culture assumes about justice and human rights and all of that, the foundation is actually in Scripture. Now, our culture doesn't recognize that anymore. It just assumes it to be true. But the foundation is actually Scripture and who God is. And then also, I hope you see that however complicated it is and wherever you land on this kind of stuff, that justice is a part of the character of God. And so as we are transformed into His followers, if you trust Jesus, that you become one, like Micah says, who does justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. So those are two things. I hope you see that justice is rooted in the Bible, this whole idea of human rights, and that followers of Him have to care about this and figure out what it looks like to kind of do that wisely. So, there are two Hebrew words, okay, Old Testament written Hebrew. The word that gets translated most often in your Old Testament for justice is mishpat, okay? But then there's another word for righteousness, tzedakah, that goes together with justice a lot. And you can see, mishpat is used 400 times, tzedakah 130. And actually, they get combined a lot, say righteousness, justice, because they go together. They get combined 50 times in the Old Testament, okay? And so the reason they go together is righteousness is this sense of things being right, of being in right relationship. It really is relational language, relationship with your neighbor, right relationship with God. That's a sense of righteousness, okay? And so, you know, kids these days, instead of saying righteous, they'd say, you know, we good. We good means like we're okay. There's nothing between us, right? Things are okay. And so that's that ethical standard of what would make me and you okay and me and my neighbor okay. That's righteousness. But then mishpat, justice, is the actual actions that you take to bring about righteousness. The particular steps that you put in place to make me and you okay, to make you and your neighborhood okay, or whatever it is. So, right, if If for some reason I stole $20 from Hugh Lee, I don't know why I'd ever do that. That'd just be a horrible thing. But if I stole it from you, right? There's no longer righteousness between us. And so there needs to be mishpat. There needs to be justice. And that means particular things would need to happen. He isn't so nice, he'd probably just forgive me. But what would need to happen is, okay, he wouldn't, good. I would actually, that $20 would need to be returned. That's mishpat. But also, I would need to do the work of rebuilding his trust. That's also mishpat. Because he would be right not to trust me anymore. And so there'd be steps over time I'd have to take to rebuild that trust. That's justice. Does that make sense? So that's a very big picture of kind of righteousness and justice and how they flow together and why they're so also often coupled together in the Old Testament. So mishpat refers justice to the actions we take to create a community of justice so that everyone is treated fairly. Everyone is treated justly. And a little simple way to remember that is you're walking in justice when other people's problems become yours. When you're willing to say, okay, well, that's not just your problem. I've actually let that become my problem, and I've let it spill over into me. That's what walking in justice begins to look like. Is I'm gonna get so near that other people's problems become mine. So you can see this in Ezekiel. If a man is righteous and practices mishpat, justice, and tzedekah, righteousness, here you go, you get it defined. He doesn't oppress anyone. He restores to the debtor his pledge. He does not commit robbery, right? So that's probably things that we think of like make recompense for wrongs. But look at the positive aspect. He gives his bread to the hungry. He covers the naked with clothing. So places that he sees, this isn't right. This isn't, people aren't being treated fairly. He moves into that and absorbs other people's problems. So that is your kind of summation of what it looks like to practice justice and righteousness. All right? So, and I know I keep saying this, but we have to in this big theme. Move quick, and we're going to stop at 10:15 to watch the video, and then we'll have a little discussion. So where does this idea of justice and righteousness, where does it find its foundation? You should be not surprised we start every single theme here. It actually starts in Genesis 1 when God creates the world, and he makes everything right, and he does something special about humanity. Right, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created male and female, he created them. Okay, so you really don't see the word justice, mishpat, until Genesis 18. We'll come to that. But the foundation of this idea of justice, of treating people according to their dignity and value, is all in Genesis 1. And it has to do with the fact that man and woman, humanity, is God's image. That every single person walking this earth bears the image of God, is made to reflect to the world what God is like in a unique way that nothing else in creation does. Other parts of creation reflect his beauty and things like that, but only man is his image. Now, why might humanity being in God's image be the foundation for justice? Anybody? Because if you lose this idea that we are made in God's image, You just lose the whole foundation of justice, I would suggest. Can anybody connect why being made in God's image is foundational to justice and righteousness? Gray, sorry. That's right. So if our design is to reflect what God is like, and God is a God of justice, which we're going to see, God is a God of righteousness, then if we're going to reflect him rightly, that must be a part of our character, first of all. But then second of all, it means that there is a sacred, transcendent dignity that every human being has. From being in the womb all the way up until death. Sacred, transcendent value. And you really see that. This is what's interesting. And, oh, Well, I didn't put that on there. In Genesis 9, you see it explicit. So Adam and Eve sin, and you see instead of, you know, other people's problems becoming our others, instead of loving and serving each other, as soon as Adam and Eve take in their hands saying, we're going to define what's right and wrong, right after that, you see Cain kill Abel, destroy the image of God. And so instead of him saying, how do I serve Abel? He crushes him to advantage himself. And it just spins and spirals out of control, Genesis 3 through 9, until you get the flood, where God, in a sense, starts again with new humanity, with Noah. But what he tells Noah is he instructs him that they can eat animals. And this is after sin has infected everything. He still holds on to the image of God because he says this. He says, whoever sheds human's blood, by humans his blood shall be shed, for the image of God he made him. And so you see, like, yes, Noah, y'all can eat these animals. You can kill animals. But you should never shed the blood of humanity, because that is God's image. There's a dignity to that. So my freshman year, I lived in Stockard. I'm sure I have diseases because I lived there. I'm still carrying around. And there was a guy on our floor who had a python in his room. That illegal, okay. No, you weren't supposed to do that. But cool as a freshman. And so like every few months, he would like call a bunch of us to come. He'd say it was time to feed his python. And so we'd all like go down, you know, into his room because he had gone to a pet store. He might have actually found them in our dorm. I don't know. And he found these mice, and he would feed them to the python. And we would watch, amazed. Awesome. Until you kind of get back to your room, and you're like, that thing is right down the hall. And you kind of thought about it when you were sleeping. You're like, this isn't that cool. But it was cool, right? And I think appropriate. But as grotesque as it is, if you fed a human child to a python, horrific crime, right? Because we all know there's a difference in value of a mouse and a human. And it's because of this. There is a unique dignity that humanity has because we are stamped with God's image. And here's what's so interesting. That is not derived. Like, the idea of human rights is not derived by looking at the world. Again, animals eat animals. It is a dog-eat-dog world. Actually, the opposite. If you just look at the world, you would assume that it's just okay to destroy each other. There's a cosmologist, Greg probably knows him, named Hugh Ross, who's a believer, and he debates other people. And he was debating this particle physicist named Victor Stringer about the reality of the Bible and God and the image of God. And he was arguing, he's an atheist, who's saying there is no God. And at the end, Victor, his last thing that he said to students, because I would say he was honest in his reasoning, he said, remember one thing, students, all you are is cold nothing. That's it. Because you've just developed by chance. And Hugh actually went and met Victor at the end and said, thank you. He said, you're the only honest person that I've debated. You're the only honest atheist scientist that's saying, you don't have a purpose if you're not made in God's image. And he said, that's right. He said, if there is no God, we're no better off than a rock or a piece of dust. And so it's not like you can look at, Greg, correct me, at science or the way the world works and say, ah, human dignity. It's actually not true. And it's not like you can look at ancient civilization and say, ah, clearly human dignity. No, like you look at ancient Greeks and Egyptians, and there's always assumed that some humans had more dignity than others. But it's because of this. Because God is a God of justice, we're to reflect what he's like, and we're made in his image, which is inherent dignity, that justice is this theme that runs throughout the Bible. And so, then, when God calls Abraham to kind of start a people group that he's going to save and make into his likeness to reflect what he's like, look what he tells Abraham. He says, I've chosen him that he command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. How is he going to keep the way of the Lord? By doing righteousness and justice. First time you see the word. So the way that this new family that God has called to himself He says it's going to become a nation that's going to bless the world. That this family of God that's going to create a people that's going to reflect what God is like, the way that they're going to do that is in justice and righteousness. And so you get this picture. Okay, this is what God's going to do. His people are going to reflect what God's, the image of God is going to be restored in them, so they begin to do justice. Then instead of disadvantaging other people so that they can build themselves up, they will actually be willing to disadvantage themselves to take on other people's problems. And the vision was actually that God's people would become a nation of such justice that other nations would look and be like, wow, they really take care of people. Who is their God? And it would draw them in. That was the vision of what was supposed to happen. But what happens, right? The next huge act of history is Exodus 5. So if we're like, okay, Abraham and his family, as they're saved, are supposed to reflect what God is like. They're supposed to do justice. What does that look like? Well, the next huge act of redemption is Exodus, where the Israelites are enslaved, they're being oppressed. And what does God do? God saves them by profound acts of justice. That's actually what it's called. Because they are, think about the Israelites under Egypt. It is political slavery, it is economic slavery, it is social slavery, it is, and of course it's spiritual. And he not only punishes Pharaoh in Egypt, though he gives them tons of chances, he also frees the Israelites to bring them into the promised land, to in a real sense restore their humanity that had been just marred. And so God defines himself as this. Blessed is he whose hope, whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord his God, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry, sets prisoners free, opens the eyes of the blind. You know what God's character is like. He is always executing justice. He's always moving towards the needy. He's always clothing the naked. He's always feeding the hungry. That is why Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. can say that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. He is pulling a Christian idea. Because God's character is justice. And because he's working in this world, that is the arc of history. And so in Deuteronomy, he gives his people the law that he has saved. And his law, if you don't think of it this way, it's a way to reflect to the world what God is like. Right? I've saved you. I'm making you like myself. You're going to show the nations what I'm like. And what he does, this law, is how to love God and how to love your neighbor. It's how to trust him, how to love him, which also means loving your neighbor, which is that rule. The word rules is the same word as justice and judgments. I've given you these laws, these things of justice that you're to begin to live out. And all of the whole Old Testament is God's people just don't really live that out. They become like the nations. They take advantage of others. They oppress others. They enslave others. They do things that are unjust. And so God ends up judging them as well. But you get these little hints of what it's supposed to look like. Melvin talks about this in one of his classes. A lot of Old Testament kind of professors talk about the quartet of the vulnerable. That you see there's these people that because of the culture, are especially vulnerable to being taken advantage of in the Old Testament. And it's orphans, widows, immigrants, and the poor. And God keeps talking about them and keeps saying that I'm the father of them. I'm the protector of them. And so should you. And you can see it in Zechariah, right? Do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the sojourner, or the poor. You can see it in Deuteronomy explicitly in his laws that God is the one who executes justice for the fatherless, the widow, and loves the sojourner. Why? Like, why were those people so vulnerable in that context? Because in that culture, what gave you security, I guess you could say, is family and land. And you start realizing orphans, immigrants, widow, and the poor, land ownership and family connection just weren't there. And it was so easy to take advantage of those people. It'd be so easy for an uncle to grab the land of a widow. And so God is saying, look, I'm going to protect the most vulnerable. And so should you if you're made in my image, because this is what I care about. And we can talk about, if we have time then, like are there equivalents of that in today's culture? What would that look like? I don't have it all figured out. But there is this quartet of the vulnerable that runs all throughout the Old Testament, that God sees them and God calls people to protect them. And when they don't, it brings out his anger, okay? A lot of places in the wisdom and in the prophets are calling out Israel, calling out God's people for not executing justice, for becoming like the nations. And then in the context of Micah's actually exposing Israelite cities and their unjust actions, because what's happening is these wealthy landowners that ran the economy, they care more about power and money than they do justice. And so they are guilty of basically buying land through bullying poor people and changing boundaries so that they were getting richer. And they bribed local judges, all this kind of stuff. And here's what God says. He says, he's told you what's required of you. To do justice, to love kindness or mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. That was Micah's call back to God's standard. And Bruce Waltke, who's this Old Testament professor, we all studied him in seminary, that's where I was. He said, if you read the book of Proverbs, here's one way to characterize the righteous and the wicked. The righteous are those who are willing to disadvantage themselves to the advantage of their community, but the wicked are those who are willing to disadvantage the community to advantage themselves. So if you read the wisdom literature, that's what righteousness and wicked, I mean, there's a lot of facets to righteousness and wickedness, but when it comes to justice, that's what it looks like. And so the history of Israel throughout the Old Testament, instead of being a nation of righteousness and justice, they oppress. And the wisdom and the prophets are calling them out for that, and there's this hope that a Messiah would come that would embody the justice and righteousness of God. Something's got to save us. Something's got to begin to do this right. And of course, Jesus shows up, God in the flesh, and he does a ton of things. But one thing he starts talking about is how do you treat the vulnerable? And he tells this parable that is incredibly convicting, okay? He says this. He said also to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. When you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the just. In other words, he's saying, okay, here's what it looks like to follow me. When you throw parties and when you invite people into your house, don't invite the people that could turn around and do something for you, which is what we all want to do. That's what I want to do. He says, invite the people that can't do anything for you. Invite the people that don't advantage you, because then you just bless them. Invite the people that do not benefit you. Which means Jesus is saying, even in the way that you throw feasts, disadvantage yourself, not to try to get something out of them, but to bless others. And that is an incredibly high calling. And one of the things that he calls the Pharisees out for, right? He says, woe to you, for you pay mint and rue and every kind of garden herb. So they're doing these tithes and they're bringing them to the temple. But he says, you disregard justice and the love of God. He says, if you're doing all these minute laws, but you disregard justice and the love of God. And he kind of says, who cares? You're missing the whole point of it. And so Jesus comes on the scene, and you start realizing, yes, this is his teaching, but so many of his miracles are restorative. Like, yeah, they're making things right. Yeah, of course, he heals a leper whose skin is falling apart. But that also enables that man to be a part of society again. To come into fellowship with other people, to get employment, all those kind of things. He's holistically caring. When he raises a widow's son from the dead, which is, on the one hand, pushing back death, which is amazing because he's life itself, that enemy death. But also, when that widow was walking with the coffin of her son, you realize that was her financial security, that was her safety. And when Jesus resurrects the son, he brings back to her protection. financially, socially, all this, because it was all hinging on having kids. And you even get these little hints that when Jesus does miracles, you get all these hints that Jesus is doing this in a way that disadvantages himself. When he heals the bleeding woman, it actually says that he felt power go out from him. I don't know what that means. But do you realize that Jesus is expending himself to heal others? That the God-man is expending himself so as to empower others. And then, of course, you go to the cross, and it is the place that you see Jesus disadvantage himself. The cross is where God looks at me and you and literally says, your problems become my problems. Our sin, our guilt, our shame, Jesus literally takes on himself. And the Father and the Son execute justice on the payment for our sin. He willingly takes it on himself so that we can be declared not guilty, so that we can be declared righteous. And then he produces a community that's supposed to live that out. So the cross is precisely that moment where love and justice meet, where the just penalty for my sin is paid for by Jesus, but also it's the place where he takes care of me and he sends the Spirit so that he promises to walk with me. That is, if you want to say, our Exodus that Exodus was pointing to. And this is where I'll end, you have Acts 6, where what did Jesus' followers look like? Well, there's these Gentile widows that aren't being taken care of. And the disciples say, somebody's got to do this. And Stephen, and they create deacons. Why? To make sure that justice is done to widows. And it starts becoming a characterization of his followers. So much so that James is going to say this, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. And so there's this picture from beginning to end that justice, I'm going to make other people's problems my own. I'm going to disadvantage myself to bless others because it's what God is like. And what he's done for me, and that creates this new community that takes care of each other, the church, and that flows out into the world. Massive 100-foot overview. We're going to watch this video and have about 5 minutes of discussion, okay? There it is. So we got a couple minutes. Any impressions? Any, I don't know, make you mad? Make you, what do you think? What came out of that? Yeah, I appreciate it. I think it's incredibly challenging. And it's incredible. And everybody's going to miss it and complicated. Like, it's incredibly challenging to figure out how best to love and to help people. I'm not saying that. But it just exposes the heart of how often I just don't want to make other people's problems my own. I just want to stay safe and even advantage myself. So, yeah, I think it's incredibly convicting. Yeah, how quickly we make snap judgments about people is pretty convicting. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That's honest. Yes. Me too. I mean, I think you nailed it. That like how this works out in our life and the best solutions, I don't think it's cowardice. I don't know. But there will be co-opted meanings of justice that aren't in line with what God says. A great book is Keller's book, Generous Justice, which walks into a lot of that kind of stuff. But I do think your conscience and a community of believers called the church need to work that out to where you can figure out what that looks like. But I'm with you. It is incredibly hard and confusing. I do think she at least makes us ask, okay, if the people who were falling through the cracks were the orphans, the widows, the poor, and the immigrant in those days because of land and all that kind of stuff, who are the people that are falling through the cracks in our world? That might be worth discussion, at the dinner table tonight. I mean, someone's coming to Bible project. I really think some of the people falling through the cracks in our world are the elderly people without means. Like if you go visit a nursing home for people that are just on Medicaid, I mean, it is hard. And I don't know what that looks like, but I do think those are some of the vulnerable in our society that are falling through the cracks that are easy to dismiss. And what does it look like to do justice in that area? I don't know, but some of that involves like, how do I think about the people that in our society, because we value youth now, fall through the cracks. Yes, Greg, would be the last thing. There you go, Melvin, who himself immigrated here, can listen to his podcast with Greg. Yeah, you talk about immigration, that's so complicated. I'm not saying I got an answer, but what does that look like to think through it? I don't know. I do know that coming to Jesus means we realize we get what we do not deserve, and he restores us, and that's supposed to create a heart of mercy towards others. And we're to trust that he's going to take care of us as we disadvantage ourselves. And that's what we start realizing. Living by faith means trusting he's going to care for me as I give things up. And that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's really hard because I realize, like, well, I don't know if I trust him if I give this up. But he said he will. He'll walk with you. So, 10:30. Thanks. That'll be it.